Okay. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for being a part of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy webinar series. I'd like to take a moment to review your control panel on your screen. All lines are currently muted and will remain so throughout the presentation. We welcome you to please write in your questions using the question option on your control panel. Your questions will then be fielded in the order they are received and will be answered at the end of the webinar. We will also be recording this presentation, and it will be made available to you on the webinar archive page of our website. And now I'd like to turn it over to Mandy.
Thank you, Erin. I'm Mandy Hancock, the high-risk energy organizer at the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Erin, if you could advance to the next slide. Thank you for attending today. Today's webinar is a great opportunity to share, learn, participate, ask questions, and get involved. For those of you not familiar with SAFE, we are a regional organization with offices in the Southeast. For over 20 years, we've been leading advocating for clean, responsible energy choices on the federal, state, and local levels. We are a membership organization, and we would like to acknowledge our members on this call and encourage those of you who are not members to join us today. You can find out more about our membership by visiting our webpage at www.cleanenergy.org. Erin, if you could advance to Peter's first slide. We have an excellent set of presenters today who will discuss some of the least desirable economic aspects of financing new nuclear projects. Our first speaker is Peter Bradford. Mr. Bradford is a former commissioner with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and served as the chair of both the New York Public Service Commission and the Maine Public Utilities Commission. Currently, Mr. Bradford is an adjunct professor at Vermont Law School. After Mr. Bradford, we will hear from Florida State Senator Mike Fasano, who is a Republican member of the Florida State Senate representing the 11th District. He has been serving in the Florida legislature in various capacities for almost 18 years, including the House of Representatives as the House Majority Leader. He sits on several committees, including the Communications, Energy, and Public Utilities Committee. Senator Fasano is term limited and is running for Florida House District 36. Senator Fasano has led a bipartisan effort to repeal the statute that allows the advanced nuclear cost recovery scheme that we will be discussing in more detail today. He has also been a strong advocate in states that have been considering similar legislation, including Missouri, Iowa, and North Carolina. Last but certainly not least, we have Bill Gupton, who is the Outreach Director of Consumers Against Rate Hikes. Bill has been instrumental in North Carolina's efforts to defeat their legislature's version of the anti-consumer legislation that we will discuss today. He will share with us the details of North Carolina's challenges in keeping this scheme from going any further in their state. We'd like to let all of our presenters get through their presentations before taking questions. And with that, let me turn the presentation over to Peter Bradford. Peter? Peter, if you'll remember to press star 6 to unmute your line. It looks like we're experiencing a small technical difficulty. If you all will just hold a moment while we get Peter on the line, just a moment.
This is Sarah Varzak with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Maybe what we should do, because I don't want to keep people on the line, and we may, as you all experience, as we called in some issues, if we could potentially forward to Bill Gupton's presentation, perhaps we should go that way. Bill, you're on the line?
Yeah, so that'd be fine.
Okay. Erin, if you wouldn't mind forwarding towards the end. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody, for attending the webinar today, and I'd like to thank Southern Alliance for Clean Energy for having Consumers Against Rate Hikes participate in this webinar. You know, the question I think that if we had heard the first two presentations is why would North Carolina even consider an annual rate hike bill? And hopefully I'll share some information and we'll hear from the other presenters. And look at some of the things that we've been doing to try and address the issue of keeping our rates fair and equitable. My hope is that this will be an opportunity to share with you some of the processes and some of the instrumental leaders that have responsibility for making these decisions. And if you're from another state, look at the similarities and differences and how this compares. And I think it's also an opportunity for us to begin a dialogue on how we can learn from each other, how we can develop alliances, and how we can share resources. Next slide. First, let me like to share with you a little bit about Consumers Against Rate Hikes. We are a coalition that ranges from organizations like AARP to North Carolina Interfaith Power and Light, the North Carolina Housing Coalition, the North Carolina Justice Society. So a diverse group of organizations, businesses, and so forth, who all have a common concern about the potential impact of an annual rate hike bill and fair and equitable rates. The other area that I think we're all concerned about is the impact on our communities, that's schools, towns, seniors, and others on fixed incomes, and the underemployed and unemployed. This is a difficult time to have significant rate hikes in this struggling economy. And we also believe that some of these investments that the utilities are taking are really, really risky, and that's the reason why Wall Street won't gamble on those, and that we believe that shareholders who reap the benefits and the rewards of these decisions should also share in the risk and cost. Next slide. So what I'd like to cover today, three main topics, the annual rate hike bill, which is our acronym for Super QIP, Construction Work in Progress. It goes by different names in different states. In Florida, it's called an Advanced Cost Recovery. They'll talk about the process and players and the regulatory environment dealing with this. Review some of the history of North Carolina rate hikes and some of the things that have taken place regarding the annual rate hike bill. And then finally, to briefly talk about an allocation issue, which is really significant in how consumers, small businesses, and local governments are being disadvantaged as related to commercial and industrial customers. Okay? Next slide. So, probably helpful, especially for those that are from other states. Historically, Duke and Progress have operated as regulated monopolies within the North Carolina service areas. They make their money by selling their electricity to various classes of customers. But one of the key points to understand is that their profits are determined as a percentage of capital invested. The more they spend on capital projects, the more that the utilities make. So that plants like the Edwards Port ICCG plant, the nuclear plants are very expensive, and they're also very profitable for the utilities. Next slide. The new Duke Energy that we've been hearing a lot about is now the largest utility in the country, having 7.1 million customers. While the merger has been approved, it's still being contested, and there's an open docket with the North Carolina Utilities Commission. But what's important for ratepayers in North Carolina over the next couple of years is that the Duke and Progress will continue to operate at separate structures. There will be separate rate hearings. They will be under separate regulations. But the area in which they will be integrated is that they now will have the combined political and social clout of the full new Duke Energy. Next slide. This is a map showing the service areas for progress in energy. Duke is in the blue. You'll note that Duke has North Carolina, South Carolina, significant presence in Indiana, presence in Ohio, and a portion of small portion of Kentucky. Progress has historically been North and South Carolina, and then the middle and upper part of Florida. This is important to keep in mind because the performance by Duke, historical Duke or legacy Progress, in their respective service areas is going to affect the financial success of the entire corporation. Duke does have operations in other countries, which does allow it an additional level of protection. While they all operate in both regulated and unregulated market, with the merger, we see a much higher level of regulation with the new Duke. Next slide. This is a map. The dots here represent municipalities that own utilities. The green areas represent the municipal, the rural co-ops. And if you overlay this with the Duke and Progress area, you see that it gets very complicated. If you look down at Southport, which is down on the North Carolina coast, that lower right-hand corner, in Southport, in that county, you have a municipal, publicly owned electric system. You have an electric co-op, and it's a Progress service area. There's a story that one of my favorite is that a developer wanted own two parcels. One of them was the utilities would come from the city. The other parcel would come from Progress. They were on the same block. So it really is a complicated matter in terms of how it impacts us, is that you really have to know the lay of the land. You really have to know who is the service provider, who is paying for the electricity, providing the electricity, and who is are the key decision makers within that local geographic area. Next slide. We'll take a look at some of the decision makers in utility regulation. The utilities, the North Carolina Utility Commission, administer the rules which are set forth by laws by the state legislators. The commissioners are, there are seven commissioners. There's currently one opening yet to be filled by the governor and confirmed by the legislators. The chair is Ed Finley. If you have a desire after this presentation to send him a note and let him know your thoughts, I've got his email address here. I urge you to go on the website and learn how to find a docket and understand this process a little bit better. Next slide. The other major player in this process is the public staff. And here's a screenshot from their homepage, and you'll see that the public staff is responsible for being the public advocate for all types of utilities, water, communication, gas, electric. And Robert Gruber is the executive director. He's been the executive director for quite a period of time. The public staff, the executive director, is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. I think an important point to keep in mind here is that the public staff represents all ratepayers. We sometimes think that, well, they're the ratepayers for residential or small business, for you and me, but really they are the advocate for all ratepayers, even when different classes of ratepayers may have conflicting goals or conflicting needs. I would encourage you to contact all the public staff. They've been very helpful in helping find information, and you also need to let the public staff know what your opinion is on a particular issue. Next slide. So these are the players, and how this plays out is in public hearings. But the utilities really don't like public hearings. In these situations, they have to present substantial evidence to demonstrate the need for the rate hike. The part that they really don't like is that groups or individuals have the ability to intervene in the rate hike. And this is really a very complicated process and something that really needs to be investigated by you and your organizations. For example, it was reported in the media that Duke was asking for a 14% rate hike. Well, what they were asking for was a 14% increase in revenue. What that translated into was almost an 18.6% increase in residential rates. So while it appeared that they were asking for a 14% increase in residential rates, there was a confusion in the media about the difference between revenue and rates. So it's up to us to look into the find out where the devil is in the details. I think it's also important to remember that because over 1,000 people turned out at these six public hearings, that there was really unprecedented comments, and instead of getting an 18.6% rate hike for residential, there was a 7.2% across the board rate hike. Next slide. So that's kind of how it's supposed to work, but keep in mind there's often a difference in how it really works. The utilities have huge political influence. In 2009-2010, Duke and Progress spent $19 million in North Carolina and federal lobbying and campaign donations. One source has indicated that Duke now is larger than the Bank of America with its PAC, and they report that since 1999, Duke has made $2.8 billion in donations and contributions, Progress $2.1 billion. So the combined Duke has made contributions to elected officials of almost $5 billion. They also are huge supporters of local communities and nonprofits, and so that puts pressure on what some of these leaders can publicly say. But what we saw at this last rate hike hearing is that 17 cities and towns across North Carolina passed resolutions opposing the rate hikes and/or joined the city of Durham in opposing the rate hike, so that there are opportunities to organize within city-county government and build alliance there. Let's turn now to what has taken place in North Carolina construction work in progress. Next slide. Before 2007, the utilities could not charge for a new plant until it generated power. But the problem that the utility presented was that Wall Street investors would not take the risk. And so in 2006 and 2007, in what is called Senate Bill 3, it was a bill which was introduced to put Renewable Energy Portfolio Standards, REPs, they're called, which are target goals for production of energy from various renewable and non-renewable sources. But added into that bill was construction work in progress that would allow the utilities to impose pre-construction and finance charges on ratepayers, but required them to go through a rate hearing. And what they're looking for now, what we're calling super quip or an annual rate hike bill, is the being able to avoid public review and have a legislation that is like what is currently in place in South Carolina and Florida. Next slide. So in 2010, we really thought that there was going to be a annual rate hike bill introduced in the next session. The Consumers Against Rate Hike, CAR-H, was formed, and we began working in that legislative session, and then all of a sudden, April 14th, Fukushima took place, and that disaster took all of the support away from Duke in terms of moving an annual rate hike bill forward. Then in July, Duke came forward and asked for almost a 20% rate hike. Even before the hearings, they had their annual fuel adjustment charge, so that tacked on another 5%. In October and November, I mentioned the six public hearings, and then even before the end of the year, they had announced that they were planning additional rate hikes even before they were approved, these current rate hikes were approved. Next slide. So turning to 2012, it's been quite a year. In February, the rate hike was settled, and instead of tiers and 18.6%, what we saw was a 7.2% rate increase across the board, and a 10.5% return on shareholder equity was approved by the Utilities Commission. In March, Attorney General Roy Cooper filed an appeal of this rate increase, not addressing the 7.2%, but that the 10.5% return on shareholder equity, which is very similar to a guaranteed rate of return, he felt that that was much too high. The public staff had recommended 9%, and so that case is pending before the North Carolina Supreme Court. We were very active, the coalition, between May 16th and July 3rd, which our legislative short session. We were involved with lobbying at the state and local levels, letters to the editors, print and radio ads, and we're very pleased that no annual rate hike was introduced in this session. So that was a major victory. And so we were following the Duke merger, and July 3rd, the Duke merger was completed, and then the fireworks began. You're all aware of a lot of the reports, a $44 million-plus severance package for a 20-minute CEO, it's been described. Then who knew what when? But I think what the media failed to address is the real critical question is, is the merger in the best financial interest of the North Carolina ratepayers? Next slide. Then in July and this month, it's been quite a ride. July 20th, the Triangle Business Journal announced that Duke was going to be making a $2 billion upgrade in the Progress nuclear fleet. This is something that had not been discussed previously, and so now North Carolina ratepayers are looking at an additional $2 billion coming through annual rate hike bill, quit charges, or rate hike increases. August 2nd, Duke announced their second quarter earnings, and they were not very impressive. The Associated Press headline read, Duke earnings up on rate hike. Their net income was up just 2%, and really if it wasn't for the rate hikes, they would have had a much worse performance. Progress, on the other hand, had dismal results, a 64% decrease in net income, due to some problems with nuclear plants in both Florida and North Carolina. It's also at this time during the Olympics that Duke launched their Feel Good campaign, which is interesting that a multimillion-dollar campaign to help focus our attention on another area. They did announce their first merger savings August 17th, And North Carolina ratepayers will save about 92 cents per month. North Carolina Progress ratepayers about 85 cents per month. This is part of the $650 million savings they've guaranteed in fuel charges over the next six and a half years. Probably one of the most significant things was in August 24th that Duke was compelled to reveal part of 17 secret deals, and in this it was revealed that it offered rebates and incentives to large customers to not oppose the merger and to protect the merger calls and future rate hikes. Next slide. So that brings us to the annual rate hike bill. And really what we're looking at is, as I said, it's an enhancement of our current construction work in progress bill. Duke says they need it. We believe that it would be the same as giving them a blank check, as we've seen what has happened in Florida. This would allow them to pass along these construction and financing costs with little public review. If the plant is canceled, there'd be no return of ratepayer money, and ratepayers would be forced to pay for cost overruns and delays, which would increase those costs. Duke often makes the argument, their mantra is safe, reliable, and affordable electricity, and we're seeing that some of these risky power plants do not live up to that. They often argue that they need these types of plants to avoid brownouts. We're interested in that coming up next month in September, they will be presenting their IRP, their Integrated Resource Plan, and which projects usage and the types of energy that they'll be producing over the next number of years. And I think this will give us some good information about what the real demand for new power plants would be. Next slide. So we see that this annual rate hike bill would be on top of a 19% increase in rates that Duke residential customers have experienced. Duke wants to invest in two William S. Lee nuclear reactors in Gaffney, South Carolina. While they're located in Gaffney, they are 70% of their power is dedicated to North Carolina. So North Carolina is going to be asked to pay for rate hikes and annual rate hike bill charges without getting the benefit of the jobs that come with that. And Duke has also announced their intention to possibly buy into a 5 to 10% share of the Santee Cooper plant down in South Carolina. The bottom line is that if they get an annual rate hike bill, if they continue on this type of path, we're going to see our North Carolina rates doubling. We're going to see loss of competitive advantage. We're going to drive away new businesses, and it's going to cost us new jobs. Next slide. So the next process is that Duke will file an intent to file 30 days before they actually file. The docket is a huge docket document, and at that time, if you would like to work on the analysis and review of that docket, we'd love to have you contact us. One of our primary things that we'll be doing after the announcement and review of the docket is to request multiple public hearings across the state so that individuals can speak out and give their mind to what they believe. Duke has said they want to announce a rate hike to pay for Cliffside and the Dan River combined cycle plants. That's about $2.4 billion. Progress has announced that they want a rate hike for three new combined cycle plants, but there hasn't been any mention of the $2.2 billion upgrade and how that will impact rate hikes. I think that it just reinforces the idea that we need to work together on these issues. Next slide. Here's a graph from North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. I highly recommend you take a look at this report. It's entitled Understanding the Impact of Electric Generation Choices on North Carolina Residential Electricity Rates. And I think it pretty clearly portrays the path that we're on in terms of raising our electric rates over time. One of the critical issues that we need to look at is how our rates, how the cost of operating expenses are allocated to various customer classes. And next slide. In this slide, you see my very technical pie chart here. Describes the allocation. It's about as clear as the allocation formulas that Duke and Progress use. You know, you really can't tell what source of electricity a particular class of customer is using, whether it's coal or nuclear or gas. So they use a variety of formulas to determine the rates. Now, one of the strongest drivers of allocating the cost to various classes of customer is based on demand during high periods. Duke uses what's called the summer coincidence peak. It is the single hottest hour of the year. Progress and Dominion use the winter-summer peak, which represents averages of the hottest and coldest days. Now, the interesting thing about using the single hottest day is that Duke is required to notify certain large customers to decrease their demand during this time. And some customers are able to go off of the grid to reduce demand through generators that they have. Some customers have installed solar panels that they can use as backup during these periods. So essentially what you have is what's called peak shaving, where you reduce the demand from a particular class of customer, large customers, commercials primarily. And so the unintended effect is that you're shifting the burden of the cost allocation to small business and residential. Next slide. So what we're seeing is that this pie chart shows that the large customers have eaten the pie and the residential and small customers are left with the crumbs, that the summer peak has been ruled by the Utilities Commission as being unfair and unreasonable twice in the last 20 years, and that we're paying for the demand from the larger customers. Next slide. It's important to understand the decision makers, and see a list here. I urge you to get to know them, get to know their hot buttons, especially the Senate and House leadership and the members of the House Public Utilities Commission. Get to know the various other decision makers and what their position is and what their level of support is. Next slide. And it's extremely important for us to reach out and network and organize with local municipal governments. And that includes both the mayor, the council member, the town manager, the town clerk, and town attorney, local business associations, downtown associations have a very big stake in new businesses and low electrical rates. And we found that public school systems are that lighting and heating and cooling is a huge bill for them, so they are very interested in protecting their budgets. And then public assistance and faith communities have see this really as a huge pocket issue for their members. Next slide. So I think it speaks to the fact that we need to start now. We need to educate people on the impact of the annual rate hike bill, rate hikes, and the allocation issue. We need to organize with both traditional and non-traditional alliances, and we need to focus public opinion on the decision makers. Final slide. And I would welcome the opportunity. Please go to our website, www.consumersagainstratehikes.org, or send me an email or give me a call. I'd be glad to talk to you about how we can work together on this issue. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill. We will now be switching over to Peter Bradford. It looks like Senator Fasano may not have been able to make the call today. He may have had a conflict arise in the meantime. So, Peter, we'll look forward to your presentation, and then we'll hold questions till the end. Thank you.
Okay. First, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. My apologies for the technical difficulties earlier. My purpose today is to give you some sense of why QIP is so unusual, a rate-making approach, and why the justifications that have been advanced for it are incorrect, and why it is so harmful when it is implemented. By way of background, QIP is a way of setting utility rates in which the customers begin to pay for utility plant even before it starts to be built, and they go on paying during the construction, and of course then they go on paying after it comes into service. That's different. Instead, we should be on the first slide now, not the title slide. That's different from the policy that built nearly all of the utility property over the last century, and the policy that I administered as a utility commission chairman for 20 years. Under the conventional approach to financing utility plant of all sorts, power plants, poles, wires, meters, pipelines, the assets are financed by borrowing or by investment. So lenders or investors put up the money, and customers start to pay only at the point in time that they begin to receive service. Next slide. So construction work in progress in the southeastern United States has been authorized by several state legislatures. It's administered by the state utilities commissions, as Bill indicated. And it really functions like a tax in that it uses the power of government to take citizens' money and spend it in a way that markets wouldn't do. And we have a clear proof of that because in the parts of the country where electric power generation is no longer rate regulated, that is the Northeast, Texas, the Pacific Coast, QIP simply can't be applied. You can't charge, you recover your money by selling kilowatt hours, and you can't charge customers for a plant that isn't selling kilowatt hours yet. So it's a counter-market way of setting utility rates, along with being completely different from the way that they have been set. And it's actually reached a point in the way that it's being administered in the Southeast now that the utilities can profit by building capital-intensive power plants, even if the plants are more expensive than other ways of providing the same service, and even if they're eventually canceled without producing any power at all. In essence, in the states where this policy has been put into place, it actually creates incentives to undertake large power plants rather than conserve or purchase power, because those approaches, even if they're more cost effective from a customer standpoint, are going to be less profitable than going forward with large plants, particularly nuclear plants, that are eligible for QIP treatment. Next slide, please. So Super QIP is an enhancement of that goes beyond just charging customers for plants before they come into service. The two additional features that constitute the difference between ordinary QIP and Super QIP is that the utilities are assured of full recovery of its costs under the terms of the law, even if the plant is canceled. So the policy in many states of only charging customers for plant that is serving them is negated. And in addition, the prudence reviews that are intended to protect customers from paying for foolish expenditures, while they're left in place in theory, they're reconfigured to require that the prudence reviews take place year by year by year, and they have to detect any imprudence in the year in which it takes place. And anyone familiar with the history of nuclear construction imprudence, of which there's been a great deal, knows that it doesn't conveniently reveal itself on an annual basis. When the diesel generator building at the Midland plant started to sink because it had been improperly grounded in the soil, it was several years later. When the seismic restraints in the Diablo Canyon plant in California turned out to have been installed incorrectly, it was discovered 7 years after the fact. Under these laws, it would be somewhere between difficult and impossible to go back and disallow those expenditures for imprudence. Next slide, please. Why is SuperQIP needed to finance nuclear plants? In a nutshell, it's because they're so expensive. The typical projections for kilowatt hours from new nuclear plants start in the range of 12 cents a kilowatt hour and go up from there. Natural gas-fired electricity under today's gas price forecast for the next 20 years likely to be under 6 cents a kilowatt hour, so less than half as much. You can't normally make money or persuade bankers and investors to finance a project that requires selling 12-cent units in a 6-cent market. The only way to do it is to shift the risk of things going wrong to the customers. It's as a result of this unfavorable cost picture that what had been called the nuclear renaissance as recently as 5 years ago is pretty much in shambles today, and the only plants still surviving are in the states that permit construction work in progress. Next slide, please. Now, legislatures and utilities commissions have been persuaded to allow QIP for combinations of the four reasons listed on this slide. It's argued that QIP will make the new plants cheaper in the long run, will create jobs, customers will be protected by prudence reviews, and we have to have QIP so that nuclear power will be available to mitigate climate change. Never mind that a number of the legislatures that have enacted QIP are adamantly skeptical of the existence of climate change. Next slide, please. The first of the myths that QIP will make new reactors cheaper is based on the proposition that it's cheaper to finance plants by getting the money from the customers than from bankers and lenders, which is obviously true as far as it goes. But if you think about it, QIP's a zero-sum game. The reason it's that money becomes available more cheaply is because risks have been shifted from sophisticated lenders and investors who charge for bearing risk if they're willing to bear it at all to customers who don't charge. And so the capital becomes either free or comes at a much lower cost. And the risks include plant cancellation, large cost overruns, the emergence of cheaper technologies. All of these things have happened in the recent history of nuclear power. So customers are promised that eventually, when the plant comes online, they'll get lower prices than they otherwise would have. But in return, what they're not told is that they're taking more risks sooner. And that's what's really become clear in Florida, where there is now a substantial chance that despite the customers of Duke now, formerly Progress, and of NextEra having put up $1 billion or so, those plants may never get built. In addition, the utility may take risks that it would not take if it had to raise the money itself. and they will de-emphasize, as they have in Florida, cheaper alternatives, especially efficiency alternatives, in order to make room for the nuclear plants and keep them in the utilities power supply plans. It's also important to keep in mind that the most sophisticated of the customers, that is the industrial customers, the guys who employ sophisticated analysts because they have million-dollar electric bills, want no part of QIP. When Georgia enacted QIP, they had to exempt the industrial customers in order to get the legislation through the legislature. So if QIP really made electric rates lower and plants cheaper, these are the first customers you would expect to have embrace it, but in fact, they're the first ones to reject it. Next slide, please. So QIP doesn't reduce any of the real costs of building a nuclear plant. Obviously, steel, concrete, and labor are still just as expensive. It doesn't eliminate any of the risks. What it does do is reallocate the risks without reducing them. Next slide, please. What about jobs? Because, of course, there are a lot of jobs involved in building a nuclear plant and a few hundred and quite well-paying jobs involved in running it. But you have to look at both sides of the equation. And if, in fact, the costs of the nuclear plant push electric rates up, as they certainly did during my tenure in the Northeast, both in Maine and in New York, what you get as a public official, I know firsthand, is a procession of executives from the customers who are big electricity users coming in and saying, look, we're in a competitive field. If our rates make our production lines uncompetitive, we will shift to the states that have lower electric rates. And it's not necessarily a matter of closing a plant. It can be a matter of shifting a production line. But the net result is that jobs are lost in the large customer sector sooner and more certainly than they may eventually be added in the building of the new nuclear plant. And it may well be that the net benefits in terms of employment are just not there, because you're also losing the jobs that would otherwise be created if the utility met its needs through cheaper energy efficiency and cogeneration types of solutions. Next slide, please. And I think we can skip this slide because we've talked already about how the prudence reviews are attenuated under the statutes relating to QIP. Finally, what about climate change and the need for new nuclear in order to combat it? Well, this slide represents the least cost, low carbon projections of the Exelon company in the upper Midwest. So this is not some environmental group or a group of anti-nuclear activists. It's the low carbon energy plan of the owner of the largest fleet of nuclear plants in the United States. And what it says about new nuclear, which is that dark blue bar to your almost right-hand end of the chart, is that it's far more expensive than quite a number of other low-carbon alternatives. We don't have time to go through them, but they're there in the coding on the right-hand side of the slide, and those of you who are interested in more detail can go to the Exelon site and look up their 20-year low-carbon plan. And basically, if you push new nuclear to the left, what you're doing is pushing those other low-cost, lower-cost alternatives off the table, and that's just not a good way to improve the state's economic profile or, for that matter, to fight climate change, since these are low-carbon solutions. Next slide, please. So QIP in context, is this a good time to be adopting it or expanding it as Duke would like to in North Carolina? Well, not really. The states that have looked at the experience in the Southeast, and especially in Florida, as Senator Pisano will indicate if he comes on the call, have declined to adopt QIP in the last year. They've specifically rejected it in both Iowa and Missouri. A number of major nuclear companies, and I'm thinking of Exelon, General Electric, NRG, now acknowledge that they just simply cannot justify going forward with new nuclear. We're seeing the cost overruns in Georgia and South Carolina, and Duke's Edwardsport coal plant, which is also built under a QIP statute, is more than 50% over budget in Indiana. So the excess risk-taking aspect is very much still with us. Next slide, please. And finally, just to give you a sense of what the economic risks in new nuclear entails that are being put on the customers because Wall Street and the banks won't take them. Half of all the nuclear plants that were ever ordered in the U.S. were canceled, so roughly 120 out of 240 were canceled. The flagship new French nuclear plant in Finland is 4 years behind schedule and 70% over budget. And in the 1990s, we spent between $50 and $300 billion in the course of electric restructuring in order to assure that utilities could recover the essentially excess costs of the nuclear plant commitments that they had made in the 70s and 80s in the face of deeper competition from other sources, notably natural gas, even before fracking. So that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Peter, and thanks, Bill, as well. We apologize again for the technological difficulties that we've had today, and also to Senator Fasano. If you are on the line, we definitely apologize for the technological problems we've had in you joining. Hi, Senator Fasano. You are with us.
I am. I have been with you from about a little before 12 o'clock. I apologize. I think I was hitting the wrong mute and unmute button, so I'm not very technologically astute at all of this, and I apologize.
No apologies necessary. I think the technological errors were on the technology's end today, and if you would like to share a few words with us, we'd love to hear from you.
Certainly. Thank you very much, and thank you for doing this, and thank you for your two earlier presenters. I won't be but a couple of minutes. I just wanted to reiterate what problems we're seeing here in Florida because of the mistake, a major mistake that we made a few years ago by passing a law that allows a charge, a fee, a tax. In my opinion, you can call it all three of what people are being, the consumer is being charged for right now to build nuclear power plants. That, in my opinion, in fact, I think the opinion of many people now in the world of nuclear power plants, that these power plants will never be built. It's almost a shameful that Progress Energy and now what Duke Energy is doing. In fact, I believe the president of Duke Energy when he came before the Public Service Commission a couple of weeks ago, came very close, in fact, to saying that they don't expect to build these nuclear power plants. In 2006, the legislature was convinced, and I was one of those members that voted for a bill that included an amendment that was adopted in a committee that would allow Florida electric companies to charge for a nuclear power plant recovery fee. At that time, we were told that it would cost between $7 and $8 billion to build these two nuclear power plants. Of course, now we've come to the realization that if they were ever to be built, it would be in excess of $20 billion, and the price tag continually rises. With the uncertainty of these nuclear power plants ever being built, those homeowners, those customers, and I happen to be one of them, continually get charged a monthly fee. It is my belief that Progress Energy, now Duke, does not have any intentions of building the nuclear power plants, but instead trying to recoup the dollars that they've already put out for permitting, purchasing of land, and whatever else that they've spent money on. And I believe that once they've recouped that close to $1 billion that they've have expended, that they will probably announce they have no intentions of building a nuclear power plants. I mean, think about it. $20 billion plus dollars to build two nuclear power plants. To recoup those dollars, the cost to the consumer, the ratepayer, would be astronomical, to a point where they would never be able to recoup those dollars. There's no financing, as we all know. There's no ability for there's no ability for them to get financing. No bank, nor New York Stock Exchange company wants to fund or finance a nuclear power plant or two nuclear power plants that truly are no longer needed in the state of Florida. When it was brought to our attention in 2006, they came and they said, because of the growth in Florida, that you will need these nuclear power plants to handle the electricity that's going to be required by the year 2016, when the nuclear power plants were to be completed. In fact, I believe it was even earlier than that they were to be completed. However, now we've come to the realization that because of the growth in our state has come to almost to a standstill, the necessity of needing additional electricity no longer exists. And instead of just being honest with the people of the state of Florida, with the ratepayers, with the Public Service Commission, and with the Florida Legislature, Progress Energy / Duke Energy, they just continue to come up with a story. In fact, there is no story. They just avoid the question every time it's asked whether they have any intentions of building the nuclear power plants. I don't think they will. I think everyone knows they won't. And yet the consumer continues to pay each month. My hope is that states like North Carolina and the good news coming out of Iowa and Missouri, that they've taken a position that they will not do what Florida, the mistake that Florida made. My hope is that North Carolina, and in fact any other state that is looking at passing legislation that would allow these multi-billion dollar corporations to recoup the cost of building a nuclear power plant in the future, that those state legislators and the governors of those states would reject that without any hesitation. Don't make the same mistake that Florida has made. I have filed legislation, and as pointed out earlier, it was a bipartisan effort with a Democratic member of the Florida House the last couple of years to repeal this. Without even getting a hearing on our legislation, it was rejected almost immediately by both chambers, the Florida House and Florida Senate, because there's a lot of politics involved in this. We recently found out that Progress Energy donated one check, gave one check, a total of $500,000, $500,000, to one of our political parties here in the state of Florida, and has given tens of thousands of dollars to the other political party. So it clearly sends a message to every customer, every ratepayer in the state of Florida, or that either has Progress Energy or Florida Power and Light, that their voices are not heard in Tallahassee, but the special interests are. The hope that I have is, though, that there's more and more members, colleagues of mine in both the Florida House and the Florida Senate, that are starting to hear from their constituents back home that enough is enough. And I've had several members of the Florida legislature reach out to me and say, you know, Fasano, maybe we do need to relook at what was done back in 06. And if they're not going to build these power plants, why do we allow them to continue to charge this fee, this tax each month? And lastly, I say a little bit here about the Public Service Commission here in Florida, and I'll make a statement here that, you know, shame on them, shame on the Public Service Commission for not asking the appropriate questions. When the president, CEO of Duke Energy, came before the Public Service Commission 2 weeks ago, they treated him with kind hands, if you will. They treated him with kid gloves. They treated him as though that they welcomed him, and that's fine. I'm glad they welcomed him. But where were the tough questions by the Public Service Commission? And they use the excuse that they have no ability to do anything because the legislature was clear in 06 and the statute is clear. I respectfully disagree with them. In fact, let me take that word away, respectfully. I totally disagree with them, and I think that they are just handing it back to the legislature because they don't want to make the tough decision. They don't want to ask the tough questions, and they allow Progress Energy and the Florida Power and Lights of the world to literally get away with anybody else would be charged with a crime. This is a scheme. It's a sham. It's It's Bernie Madoffs of the world would give Progress Energy an award for what they've accomplished over the last 6 years by being able to charge a customer for a product that will never be developed. And I'll be more than happy to take any questions at the end if anyone has any.
Thank you, Senator Fasano, and we're glad that you were able to join us today to give the perspective of Florida. We had a bunch of great presentations today. This has been the August webinar in our monthly series. We are going to open it up now for questions and answers. If folks have questions, if you can type them into the chat box, and we will start answering questions now. If you have a specific person you're directing the question to, if you could specify that in your questions.
Okay, Mandy, I'll read off the questions now. And sometimes we don't have a specific person that the question is directed to. So presenters, I guess you can field the questions. The first question, with the merger, will Florida ratepayers be contributing to North Carolina costs and vice versa?
This is Peter Bradford. My guess is not, at least not directly, although there will probably be some Duke overhead costs allocated to its Florida subsidiaries. But one of my concerns with these QIP laws is I believe some of these plants are going to be canceled, and there'll be some shuffling around of the ownership. But the new owners aren't going to be likely to want to pay the past QIP charges. They're going to bargain, and they're going to base their bargaining on what their other choices are. So if, say, Levy County or Turkey Point are among the surviving plants, it is possible that a utility in Georgia or South Carolina buying into them will insist on paying a price that doesn't include the full sunk costs, and in that case, definitely Florida customers could wind up subsidizing nuclear power customers in other states, and vice versa.
Okay, we have another question. What is the mechanism that dictates that the utility's profits are determined by a percentage of their investment? Is there a way to change that so that they can have an incentive to save money?
I'll be glad to touch on that question here in Florida. Statutorily, here in Florida, a utility company is allowed to get a certain amount of return on their investment. Of course, that can be adjusted, but slightly, by the Public Service Commission. Through some excellent reporting by Ivan Penn in the Tampa Bay Times, it was found out that Progress Energy, even if they had to not return the money, because they'll never return the money, but even if they don't build the nuclear power plants, it was determined through good reporting by Ivan Penn that Progress Energy, now Duke, will get a return on their investment even if the nuclear power plants will not be built. And I think that return is in excess of $100 million, somewhere about $130 million. So it is determined by the Public Service Commission. Statutorily, we can absolutely make some changes, and that's what I would like to see if the legislature would go along with me to make some changes as to what the rate of return they can get on their investment. And, yes, there are some things that the Public Service Commission can do as far as requiring some incentives that would allow maybe a lower rate of return or even an increased rate of return if they were to create some incentives to reduce the cost to the customer.
And this will build up. I think in North Carolina, the time to address that is at the upcoming rate hikes, where the amount of guaranteed return on shareholder equity needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, it's an issue that has sometimes been negotiated up front before it's really fully dealt. And I think that's the reason why the Attorney General is pursuing that, and I think that's why AARP North Carolina has just joined in that and intervened in that issue of the guaranteed return on equity.
This is Peter Bradford. You know, there are rate-making approaches used in other states that don't involve a guaranteed or, for that matter, return on equity calculation at all. There's performance-based regulation and various kinds of revenue cap approaches in which the utility basically makes its money by improving its efficiency against its existing rates. And they may earn more or they may earn less in states that do it the way Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina do it. But the commissioners don't sit around calculating what the return on equity should be. They function off of changes in the prices in relation to changes in other costs in the economy. And in that type of rate-making system, you just won't see utilities going off on these nuclear construction binges. The risks are too great.
Those were great presentations and a great discussion that followed. Again, we would like to apologize for the technological difficulties that we went through today. I think we had a great webinar nonetheless, and we appreciate everyone's patience in staying through to the end. I would like to thank you all for attending today. SACE's webinar series is a great new way for us to connect with you on our issues. This has been the August webinar in our monthly series, and your feedback is very important to us. Remember that the audio portion of today's webinar, along with the presentations, will be available in the near future, on our website under webinars at www.cleanenergy.org. And with that, thank you all for attending today. We appreciate your questions and your support of SACE. We look forward to hearing from you.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye, Sarah.